Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Cool Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff. Or as we might call it this week, generally good but sometimes morally questionable people who do morally and strategically questionable things in support of cool causes.
Yay.
I'm your host, Margaret Killjoy. And with me celebrating today is Snow. Hi, Snow.
Hi.
I never remember whether I'm supposed to shout out your affiliations or not.
That's okay, I think.
Okay, great. Just Snow. Our producer is Sophie.
Hey.
Our audio engineer is Daniel. Our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. Snow, you ever heard of Bank Robbery?
Yeah, I've seen Heat.
Yeah, I like that movie. I haven't seen that movie in so long that it was on two VHS tapes.
Wow.
I was like, whoa, this movie's long. It must be important.
Some would say.
Do you think that the reason that movies got longer is because they're no longer on VHS tapes?
I mean, what was that year? It was like 2010 or whatever. And every single like final movie in a series was two fucking parts. And
yeah.
They didn't all need to be two parts.
Oh, like no. when they made the Hobbit movie like three or four parts.
Yeah.
Which, you know.
Oh, I'm a little bit of a sucker for that one.
Which,
but that's,
which was
that's
like
my
cool.
Cancelable take.
Yeah, which was cool for like us.
Yeah.
But like then every movie did that.
Yeah. Like I love Twilight, but Breaking Dawn did not need to be two parts.
It did not need to be two parts.
I think that miniseries are overall a better format for long-form storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a sucker for a good three-hour movie. I don't remember how long Heat is. I just remember it's on two VHS tapes.
I think it's like, yeah, two some.
Yeah. Okay. So today, we're going to talk about some bank robbers and some basically lots of other stuff robbers. I don't know if I'm going to name the episode this because it might confuse people about what it's about, but I'm going to refer to this overall as what I'm going to call the Robin Hood problem. Because robbing the rich looks really good on paper and it often seems worth doing historically. I would never advocate that anyone do anything ever, but it gets really messy when you get into the details. So that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about that. So the short version of the story that we're going to tell today. It's about anarchist expropriators in Argentina and Uruguay from 1919 to 1934 or so. During that time, a motley assortment of workers, academics, and professional criminals, all of them illegalist anarchists, form a whole bunch of bank robbing gangs and went around expropriating funds for the revolution.
Hell yeah.
It goes about as well as that ever does, which is sometimes they made a bunch of money for really good causes. Sometimes they killed innocent people. And I will argue that some of them, not actually all of them, kind of got caught up in the clandestinity spiral where they get increasingly alienated from society and even their own movement, which was deeply fractured by arguments about whether or not to support the robberies. And I don't know whether you can blame the lack of support on the robbers or not, you know, but most of the robbers die in a hail of gunfire or disappeared by the government. But, you know, that's every revolutionary I talk about. That's not unique to this particular tactic. One of them survives to become the most famous anarchist general in history, who is a major figure in the Spanish Civil War. Along the way, they break each other out of prison. They assassinate police investigators, and they get caught up in an awful lot of Hollywood-style chase scenes. Just over and over again, they're running through the streets or driving cars very quickly through the streets, shooting out the back window and things like that.
So this is like the 19th century Fast and Furious, but leftist.
Yeah, 1920 or so, not 19th century, but this really...
That's right.
This is really Fast and Furious. That's what this is.
Family.
Yeah. This is leftist Fast and Furious. One of my favorite long... Why do I like movies like that? Whatever. I guess partly we're going to talk about what's appealing about those sorts of things. You like those movies?
Fast and Furious?
Yeah.
You know, some of them, I will admit... Maybe I shouldn't even say this because people are going to roast me. But the last one, there's a scene where, what the fuck is that guy's name? I don't
know. Very tall man.
Vin Diesel's brother in the movie, like, sacrifices himself for his nephew, aka Vin Diesel's son. And I cried, dog.
That's fair.
And I was like, why am I crying while watching Fast and Furious?
I appreciate that as someone who cries at the wrong parts of movies. Or at the wrong movies, you know? Most of our story is going to be set in Argentina, especially Buenos Aires, which is the capital of Argentina. Some of it is going to happen right across the Rio de la Plata, which is the river that separates Argentina from Uruguay. And it's worth understanding, the last episodes we did about Argentina happened mostly in Patagonia, which is far to the south of Argentina. Uruguay is way closer to Buenos Aires than Patagonia is. So it's, when I'm talking about all the stuff that's going to happen, think about it like bank robbers in Los Angeles going over to Tijuana rather than like bank robbers in Los Angeles going to Brazil to do yet another heist where they go into space. I still haven't seen the Fast and Furious where they go into space. But Argentina, at the end of the 1910s, is alive with revolution. The majority of the working class is organized into anarchist unions, although there's also these sort of like liberal slash Marxist neutral syndicalist unions that are doing their thing. Sometimes they're coordinating with the anarchists, sometimes they're not. There's this whole revolution in Russia. I don't know if you heard about this, but there's a little scuffle over in Russia. And all over the world, people are wondering, are we going to do the same thing? Can we pull it off? And this is largely before the Bolsheviks have shown their true colors, before they repressed all the other communist groups, and so they're still supported everywhere. The right-wing government has just been ousted in the elections, and the middle-class liberals are taking control of Argentina.
Hate it when that happens.
I know. Well, I mean, it's funny because it seemed like this, like, real good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they were just as repressive of the workers' movements as the authoritarians who came before them. And if you want a deep dive of the Argentinian situation, I did a four-parter with Mia Wong about the rebellion in Patagonia, which is when, right at the start of today's story, thousands of indigenous and immigrant folks organized by anarchist unions staged a massive rural strike in Patagonia, only to be mass murdered. About 1,500 workers were like forced to dig their own graves and stuff by this liberal government, who then immediately was like, oh, maybe we overstepped. You, that one guy who overstepped, you're in trouble, but not really. We're just going to give you a desk job.
If you knew you were digging your own grave, would you dig it faster or slower?
So this is like, actually, we talked about this on the last episode. I've always wondered about people digging their own grave. And because I'm always surprised. I understand why some people do it, but it always seemed like it would be a crapshoot. It always seemed to me it'd be like 50-50 that people would like dig their own grave versus like be like, fuck you, I won't, and stand there and wait to get shot. Or like, just like, go claws out and teeth and try and rip out people's throats and get shot down, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I would probably dig slower if I were to dig at all. Because if I was digging at all, it would be to hope that something miraculous would happen.
Oh, I think I'd fucking lose it.
Yeah. There's actually a couple people later in this story where they like talk about, I didn't end up writing into the script, but they had these like long conversations where they're like, well, what are you going to do? Like when we're eventually caught, right?
Right.
So everyone had just survived the tragic week in Buenos Aires of 1919, in which during a general strike, the ostensibly liberal government worked hand in hand with both the right-wing military and the far-right paramilitary Patriotic League to kill 700 workers. This is completely unrelated to the Patagonia thing. This is just yet another massive massacre done by the liberal government. A lot of the killing was done by a far-right paramilitary group called the Patriotic League. And most of the people who were killed were Jews. This was often called Argentina's first pogrom. And it was a pogrom and strike breaking all in one. 50,000 workers were arrested during that week, which is a really large number of people to arrest. And this didn't stop the workers. They managed 367 strikes in 1919.
Damn.
Which is, for those keeping track, more strikes than there are days in the year.
That's hot.
Yeah. Like, the thing that's so interesting and appealing to me about this time period is how much they're doing all of these different tactics, you know? Like, and for a little while, they're all, like, kind of, all the different tactics are working together. And for some reason, that's when their movement is strongest. No lessons to take from that.
No.
But after the tragic week, like, and after the rebellion in Patagonia and all of these other things, the left is no longer at its like zenith. And today's story focuses on something we've seen time and time again on this show, most notably in the aftermath of, like, we did a lot of episodes about late 60s radical movements like the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, Students for Democratic Society, all of those. And how when mass movements start coming down from their zenith, usually as a result of oppression, groups tend to splinter off into further clandestinity, which increasingly alienates them from everyone else, and they make tragic or heroic figures. And occasionally they do really awful things. Sometimes they do really amazing things. Argentina. We're going to talk about some Robin Hoods. Our first hero is an intellectual. He is a descendant of Russian royalty. His name is Boris Vladimirovich. He's 43 years old in 1919 when all this stuff starts happening, which is older than most of our, like, usual guns out type heroes.
Or for, like, tuberculosis, right? That seems to be friend of the pod.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's made it through. He's made it into his 40s. At that point, what do you have left to live for? Which is actually kind of his story. He'd become a revolutionary years earlier. He'd been recruited in the classic way. He'd fallen in love with a revolutionary. At 29, he renounced his inheritance to marry a revolutionary and then spent all of his remaining money on the movement. It says renounce his inheritance, and then it keeps describing him having money for a little while
longer.
Yeah,
I was just going to say. So it's like couch money, like, you know, his allowance?
I think he like steps out of the family, but he already has like some property and stuff that he's gotten, you know?
Okay. Okay.
So he spends all that remaining couch money on the movement. He's such a funny figure to me. I really like him. And like, whatever. He's just interesting. He's a doctor and a biologist, but in classic aristocratic form. He doesn't actually practice as a doctor. He just like has his doctor degree but like in medicine. But
he doesn't use it?
No, he just studies and writes books. He's like a amateur scientist guy. He hangs out at the thing where you look at the stars, the observatory, a lot.
Nerd. Yeah. Nerd.
He just studies and writes books. He speaks and writes German, Spanish, French, Russian, and, quote, most of the tongues and dialects in use in his mother country of Russia, which is a lot more languages than just Russian. He never loses his taste for the high life. And whenever he gets any money from anything, he spends it immediately on, like, fancy meals at restaurants and shit. And I'm unsure, he's referred to as a widower. And I'm unsure exactly when his wife died, because why would historians bother to write about her, the woman who radicalized him and therefore was radical before him. It's men who make history. And this is me being angry at like half the historians I read who just don't even, I don't know her name. Just, you know.
There's no mention at all?
No, no mention of her name. Just, you know, he's a widower. She made him an anarchist. That's the one good thing. No, whatever. Somewhere along the way, around 1905 or so, he has a falling out with Lenin, like personally, and he becomes an anarchist.
That'll happen.
Yeah.
I hear that happens a lot.
Yeah. He seems like kind of a guy who might rub some people the wrong way. And my best guess is that his wife is still alive and they like both fall out with Lenin and they both become anarchists, but I'm not sure. I think that she dies in the 1905 revolution. And his life just kind of falls apart, right? The revolution has failed. The love of his life is gone. Fortunately, there's another thing that he falls in love with.
Himself?
No, actually, I don't think he thinks very highly of himself, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Which is, he's a different kind of, no, he falls in love with vodka.
Oh, okay. Also, that happens.
Yeah. He also was in love with all of the goods and services that support this show.
I had a feeling that's where you were going with that.
Sophie knows me too well.
Vodka, products, services.
Yeah. So, you know, if you too have a hole in your life because of a failed revolution and the love of your life has died, fill it. Fill it immediately with all of these things, unless they're telling you to become an employee of the carceral system, in which case, ignore that one.
Mm-hmm.
Here's ads.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now. Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
And we're back. So he's like lost. He's not sure what he's going to do. So the first thing he does is he gives his house in Geneva to the anarchists. Because again, this is like multiple times that he's given up his inheritance and then like given away all of his money. And at this point, he gives away his house. I think at this point, he actually genuinely now has essentially nothing. He moves to Paris and then he moves to Argentina in 1909. And he travels around. He travels around drinking, studying the geography of the country, writing sociological books, drinking, offering language classes, selling paintings, giving lectures on anarchism, and drinking.
Living the fast life, as they say.
Yeah. I feel like he'd be, like, this is the kind of guy who's either the worst or really cool. You know?
Why not both?
Oh, interesting.
You ever think about that?
I lean towards I think he's, like, kind of fun. I think he'd be fun to hang out with. And except when he's probably wildly depressed. I don't know, whatever. We can hang out with depressed people. We can be depressed. It's okay. He is like a fucking archetypical character from Russian literature, especially how he ends his life. But we'll get to that. Being Russian puts him in an interesting position. First of all, you have pogroms of the tragic week. And these pogroms are specifically anti-Semitic. It's part of the whole being a pogrom thing. But the word that was used for Jew in Argentina at the time was Russian. The Russians had to be stopped because they were importing the Russian Revolution. So we'd better kill all the Jews. People will look for any excuse in history to kill all the Jews.
And people were just like, yeah, we should do that.
Yeah. About 80% of the Russian immigrants in Argentina were Jewish. And even though Boris is not, but almost everyone is. And yeah, no, people were like, oh, well, we hate the Russians and we have no problem with just hating an entire ethnic group. So this is what we're going to do. It is not an easy time to be a Russian immigrant. And kudos to him. I don't think he like ran around being like, I swear I'm not a Jew.
Like, that'll help. Yeah.
He kind of ran around not doing the opposite, saying I am Jewish, but he ran around doing the opposite, being like, this is bad. You can't. This anti-Semitism and anti-Russian stuff is got to stop. But as for importing the Russian Revolution, this is something Boris is trying to do. You had this big split. The first big split within the Argentinian anarchist movement that I'm aware of is happening at this time. A sizable minority of the anarchists are what is known as the Bolshevik anarchists. They support the Russian Revolution and the Bolsheviks specifically. They're like, look, this is the best thing going. It's not ideologically perfect, but, you know, I'm sure once the Civil War is done, the Bolsheviks will like do what's right and allow for political pluralism in Russia and not.
And be like super chill.
Leftists. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll be super chill, I think.
Well, Snow, you'll be shocked to know that that's not how it ends up.
Well, I seen Anastasia, you know, if that says anything.
I haven't, but
it's a good movie.
It's a bop. Well,
yeah.
It, if you see it, you can't unsee it. That's what I'm saying. Like, it sticks with you.
Okay. So that's about a Bolshevik anarchist princess, right?
You know, I guess you'll have to watch it to find out. Yeah, no spoilers.
This is not a movie rewatch podcast.
Fine. It's kind of a movie rewatch podcast of history instead.
Valid.
Where we all talk shit on. These anarchists, they're called maximalists, since that is a word that is used for Bolsheviks. And their newspaper is called Bandera Roja, Red Flag. The other anarchists are like, that's not it. Y'all, it's going to go badly. But Boris, our first hero, he's a maximalist. He's a Bolshevik anarchist. And he's very specifically concerned with spreading the good word of the Russian Revolution to the Russian-speaking people of Argentina. And he has a lot of anti-Russian and anti-Jewish propaganda to counter. Even some of the radical papers at the time were publishing things like, and I don't actually know which paper this is from, and I'm annoyed that I don't know, but publishing things like, quote, those who leave Russia for Argentina are the dregs of the people, above all the Jews, taken all in all, represent an incoherent mass incapable of establishing a serious revolutionary program, much less putting a grand theory into practice.
That's a long title.
Oh, it's not the title of the paper. No, that's just the...
Oh, it's just a quote.
Yeah. No, I don't know the name of the paper, unfortunately. Because I have more opinions about infighting between different radical presses in 1920s Argentina than I do about what's happening now, because I've made some decisions with my life. And so he's like, all right, I gotta do a discourse. I gotta set the record straight. I'm gonna start a newspaper, which again is a thing lots of people did then, but I'm not recommending it now.
Well, it's like, you know, every affinity group has like their own zines. I feel like that's the equivalent, the modern equivalent.
That is definitely it. It is like, yeah, they all have their own podcast. They all have their own zines.
Yeah. Let's start a podcast.
Yeah. I would rather you start a newspaper, dear listener, a podcast than a newspaper in terms of any chance of actually reaching people. That said, whatever, there's still some radical newspapers. Anyway, did you know that to start a newspaper, you need money?
And he doesn't have any anymore, right?
So he thinks to himself, how should I get some money? Because at the moment, he's like living off of selling paintings and language tutoring. Just not a middle class income for him. So he starts a hot new trend in Argentina. He learns that if you point a gun at someone, they'll give you their stuff.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. He also learns that most of the time that goes really badly. But...
well, yeah, you gotta have a plan.
Yeah, even plans don't. Well, I'll tell you about it. You can come to your own conclusion that I lead you carefully towards as the writer of this script.
Okay.
He recruits two of his friends, one of whom is his roommate, and they set about to work. An anarchist cab driver tips them off about this couple who runs a currency exchange and how they travel home with the profits in a suitcase on the tram every evening on the way home from work. And he's like, oh, well, that's where we'll get the money.
Yeah, easy target.
Yeah, the robbers do their homework. They tail the couple home every day for a while. And the wife is like, hey, I feel like we keep seeing the same two guys and they're always staring at us. And the husband's
oh,
like,
oh, man.
The husband's like, nah, you're just a crazy woman with crazy woman thoughts.
Classic.
He told her he was imagining it. Actually, I guess he does survive. I was going to say his life would be a lot better if he had listened to his wife, but, you know. On May 19th, 1919, which is too many 19s in a date, the robbers follow the couple home from work. One of the robbers is on the tram. Two are in the car behind the tram. Boris is in the getaway car. He's not driving it. He's like ready to pop out and help or whatever. As soon as the marks get off at the stop, the robber on the tram gets off too. And the getaway car stops behind the tram. And Boris is in the getaway car. At this point, the couple is like, oh, we're in trouble. The robbery does not go well. The man refused to release the briefcase. One robber starts shooting, just kind of at random. Two cops show up and start shooting too. This is
oh my God.
Yeah. This is too many bullets for a crowded public place. The robber gets the suitcase and takes off running. And instead of running to the escape car, he's like freaked out. So he just takes off running a different direction. And he is firing wildly behind him. And that said, he has a revolver. So I feel like he couldn't be firing wildly that long, right?
Yeah.
7 shots max. My money's on 5.
Yeah.
And one bullet hits the tram driver. This is a ricochet. It doesn't penetrate his coat and he is uninjured. Another bullet gets a cop in the foot. And actually the ricochet is off the ground too. So clearly there's some like downward angle shooting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's that shot anticipation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just low left. Just,
Support hand pressure.
Yeah.
You know?
See, this is why we got to get you a time machine and you can go back and tell these old timey anarchists how to actually shoot. Because we talked about this in the Nihilist episode where like, actually later anarchists figured this out way better. But like 1870s anarchists were like, we don't know how to shoot. We have a gun that's like a magic talisman that just allows us to kill whoever we want, right? And they just fail time and time again.
Man.
But the robber runs. A cop, like, he's like running down the street and some cops live on the street and they hear the ruckus and they come outside and he shoots one of the cops dead. He doesn't shot anticipating. His bullet strikes home. And then he takes refuge in a coal depot at the end of the street. This is not the last coal depot that's going to be in this story.
What is a coal depot?
It's where the coal is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, everything's running off of coal, and I assume people are heating their homes and stuff with coal, right? And all these things. So, like, it's a much bigger deal, I think, at the time. The guy who works at the coal depot is shot in the eye by a cop.
Oh, my God.
The robber gets shot in the arm and then gets arrested. So, one dead cop, one very injured robber, one very injured worker, and no money.
Oh, my God. He didn't die from getting shot in the eye?
No, I couldn't tell you exactly how that happened.
Wow.
But yeah, glad for him.
That's crazy.
So he gets arrested and he gives a fake name and he gives like a, he's like, I'm Juan Konovusik. His name is Andre Babi. He's Austrian.
Oh, pretty close.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was like he clearly couldn't hide his like nationality completely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, oh, I'm Juan. He's 30 years old. He's a bookkeeper. He's Boris's roommate. And during the investigation, he like gives this elaborate made up story that he was just an unemployed guy who'd been sitting in a park one day when he was approached by Jose the German. And Jose, and Jose the German had a big bushy mustache and offered him a few pesos to snatch a briefcase. That's his cover story.
He didn't think of that ahead of time, did he?
Yeah, I know, right? That's some off the cuff shit.
Man.
But this kind of works for a minute. All the newspapers are like, everyone's like freaked out by this. It's like big news, right? All the newspapers are like, we got to come together as a society to find Jose the German.
People are buying this?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I think the cops aren't, but the newspapers are.
Okay.
Dozens of people are reported to the cops as being like sketchy Germans with big mustaches. Probably that's Jose.
I feel like that era was the era of the stash.
It was. It absolutely was. The cops got tipped off to Andre's address, and they found out he had a roommate who was a German-ish guy. I know that I've been calling him Russian, but apparently he like also reads as German, or maybe it was Belarusian. It's like, it's all messy, but he's whatever. And they're like, oh, his roommate is Boris Vladimirovich. Boris is long gone. He never went home after the robbery went south.
That's smart.
Yeah. The cops searched his apartment and found a photo of Boris. So now they had a photo of him. They also figured out that he was an amateur astronomer, because of course he was, because he's a quintessential jack of all trades, drunk, formal nobleman, now anarchist. And he'd often been seen at the observatory. So they go to the observatory. Where do they find but his suitcases? And his suitcases are full of books, like anarchist books, and all of his like letters. And somehow from here, they also catch the getaway driver. And Boris is arrested in a nearby province. And while he's in jail, he kind of becomes a celebrity. And he's like an oddity. Like, why is this learned man just robbing some people? Like, what's his side? They all want to know. The governor of the province drove down just to talk with the guy in prison out of curiosity before he gets extradited back to Buenos Aires.
That's and so, so many, interesting.
So many like politicians and other like people who could break the rules were going to go visit him that the national government had to intervene and be like, no visitors means no visitors, including you governors. Stop visiting him.
That is so crazy.
Yeah. The case gets a ton of press attention. Babby, the robber who'd killed a cop, was initially given the death penalty, while Boris got 15 years and the driver got 2 years. This was reduced on appeal to 25 years and 10 years and 1 year, respectively. And then it was changed again to be the death penalty for the two of them. Basically, it's like every time the...
What?
So basically, like, both the far right and the far left, which are a huge chunk of Argentinian society, both, like... very polarized society, completely unknown to modern American listeners.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So whenever the like state like lowers the sentence, the right wingers are like, what the hell? You're going to let these cop killers walk, you know? And then as soon as they bring it back up again, and now it's the death penalty again for the two of them, then the leftists are like, what the hell? You're going to make them a martyr. And the government's like, ooh, we don't want a martyr.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So it gets changed again, one more time. Life in prison for the robber and the mastermind, and I don't know what the driver got. Boris was told his sentence, and he said, "The life of a propagandist of ideas such as myself is at the mercy of such contingencies, now and in the future. I am well aware that I shall not see my ideas succeed, but others will sooner or later take up the baton."
Yeah, you know. Classic anarchist relay.
Yeah.
To the end.
Yeah. The infinite, the Sisyphusian relay. Prison is terrible for his health. He soon sickens and dies. But first, this isn't an ad transition. First, he manages to murder a fascist.
In jail?
Yeah. Well, he masterminds. That's kind of his thing, is he's like the mastermind, right? I mean, the only thing he's masterminded so far failed dramatically. But this next one doesn't. I told a story last time to Mia about how like thousands and thousands of anarchist immigrants and indigenous folks had thrown this huge rural strike, and the supposedly liberal government had massacred them, killing 1,500 workers. And this guy Valera, this like, I think, lieutenant colonel, he's responsible for all that death. So this previously pacifist Christian anarchist named Kurt Wilkins kills Valera in the street. So then Kurt...
with the bomb, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then Kurt is killed in prison by a fascist hired by the state to do the killing. Or he's like, he wants to do it. And then like the state helps him figure out how to do it, you know? And then to keep him safe, he now has to go to prison, right? Because he killed a prisoner. And so he's sent to a mental institution because they want to like keep him out of, you know, where they figure if he stays in regular jail, he'll get killed.
Yeah.
So eventually this this person that I've either read as a little person or someone who has physical deformities, but a person who is otherwise abled or whatever, kills the fascist with a gun that had been smuggled into the mental institution by our man, Boris.
Okay, Boris.
Because Boris had been in a regular prison when he heard that this fascist assassin was taken to an asylum. So he fakes a nervous breakdown, which I have a feeling he's good at, because this is not this man's first nervous breakdown.
Yeah, that's right.
He gets himself transferred to the asylum so that he could kill this guy, and then does. And there's no criminal persecutions that succeed at that particular revenge killing, because even though they catch all of the conspirators, none of them talk. And so there's like not enough evidence, and all the witnesses are like in an asylum and therefore like not reliable. And also like the actual person who pulled the trigger, you know, is not fit to stand trial, has already been proven not capable of standing trial, right? But his role in killing the fascist caused the state to treat him way worse in prison. And that's how he dies.
Damn.
He spends the last years of his life with his legs paralyzed, and they give him no mobility aids in prison, and he's forced to crawl around the prison.
Why were his legs paralyzed?
I don't know. That annoyingly light on the details, both the books that I've read about this guy. I'm annoyed. But
I just feel like there's a story behind that.
I know.
I guess not. I guess not.
I know. Someone knows. And the answer has probably not yet been translated to English.
Yeah.
But maybe his legs just stopped working because he had to be a tragic Russian literature figure. You know?
Yeah. Got to read the side effects more carefully.
Yeah. Of being a Russian literature guy.
Yeah.
It's pretty much all bad. There's no positive effects of being a character in a Russian literature.
Noted.
So, yeah. But you know what doesn't have any side effects?
Oh.
Purchasing stuff from advertisers. It's always good. And if any of them are drugs, you can ignore. No. You can't ignore their side effects. No. I'm sorry. I've misled you. Well, on that note, here are the ads.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists, like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered.
for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
And we're back. So this expropriation, or rather failed expropriation, it kicks off serious debates in the anarchist scene. And by debates, I mean people on both sides of this debate are going to kill each other.
Oh.
Yeah. If you think infighting is bad in North America right now in the anarchist scene, wait till you hear about 1920s Argentina.
Will it make me feel better?
I guess so, because it, or you'll feel like we're doomed into a spiral that will inevitably lead us to this point, depending on how optimistic you're feeling.
Okay, well, I'll check in.
Okay. Some folks say support our Robin Hoods. Others say they discredit the libertarian struggle. And by libertarian, they mean libertarian socialism. Like, they mean anarchism.
Yeah.
I know you know that, but I feel like every time I say libertarian on this show, I'm like, I need to point out what I'm saying in case this is someone's first episode.
Fair.
The largest chunk of the anarchists were the moderate anarchists, and they did not want to support what they called anarcho-banditry. And this included the huge anarcho-syndicalist union Fora that so much of the last Argentina series was about, as well as the intellectuals in the biggest anarchist newspaper, La Protesta. So another paper, like we were talking about, every crew has their zine, you know?
Right.
Another paper, La Antorcha, which is the torch, they supported direct action and they split off from La Protesta over this disagreement. It's kind of funny because they were like, look, we don't hate these people, but they're not doing what's right. They're like, they're very, well, I'll talk about it more later, but they're not like, hooray, we love all the robbery, right? They're just like, we're not going to cast these people out for having done a robbery. The non-aligned trade unions also support this, the anarcho-bandits, and or specifically, they would probably frame it, they support illegal actions against the bourgeoisie, because those are necessary,
I mean,
and good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the next expropriation came on May 2nd, 1921, when robbers got 620,000 pesetas, which is a lot of money, but I could not find a way to grasp exactly how much. But okay. Everyone assumed this was the anarchists, but this was actually an apolitical crime, but it kind of gets blamed on the anarchists, right?
Oh, man.
And
false flag.
Yeah. Well, and that's La Antorcha's stance, is they're like, anyway, well, I'll keep talking about this. So it's this apolitical crime, except that it's, of course, the crime that's a result of systemic poverty and people
All that usual stuff.
Yeah. All the 11 robbers get caught. Three of them were professional criminals. The rest were workers. And so you've got La Protesta, which is opposed to political robbery and crime in general. But La Antorcha was like, they're not like, hell yeah, let's go rob and steal and occasionally murder. They're like, I can see both sides of this. La Antorcha came out sort of neutral about them, saying the only robbers in these parts are the property owners.
Yup.
But they're also like, okay, so are these folks just trying to get rich themselves by robbing other people? Or is it for struggle? And I actually really like the statement that La Antorcha wrote. What is the robber's object? To seize wealth, or at any rate, to avoid the toil and the slavery that flow from it. In order to escape enslavement, he gambles his freedom and generally loses it, in that the bourgeoisie are experts of this little game, and really, it is they who deal the cards. Should some petty thief succeed in this game, he becomes rich, a property owner, which is to say, a big thief. But for all of that, and although they may be thieves, we are more on the side of the outlaws than the others, more on the side of the petty thieves than the big ones, more with the custom post raiders than President Irigoyen and his ministers. May their example prosper.
That is sick as fuck. And nothing ever changes, ever.
I know. I know. But most of the time when nothing ever changes, it makes me sad. But sometimes I'm like, this statement that was written 100 years ago is really well done and is useful.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that is like, so it's not, so some things have, like, the conditions have not necessarily totally changed, but it also means that, like, some of the things that people, like, said and did are, like, useful to read and pay attention to, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, like, agitational message.
Yeah, totally.
Makes you think.
And so this split, the anarcho-banditry, are we against them or neutral on them? This replaces the old split. There's no more anarcho-Bolsheviks by the early 1920s because the Bolsheviks in Russia killed all the anarchists they could at that point. And the anarchists in other countries were like, oh, turns out the Bolsheviks just created a dictatorship.
Hate when that happens.
I really do. I hate it more than most things that I hate in this world.
Yeah.
It feels like a gut punch when you're just like, I can't even imagine what it would feel like to be alive during that time, you know?
Oh my God.
The greatest revolution that the world had ever seen was then betrayed, captured, and turned into exactly the thing that it claimed to be against.
Exactly. Yeah.
I honestly wonder how people kept struggling. I'm like really impressed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Partly is because they needed to. Because there's this new ideology that's emerged on the scene. Came from Italy. It's called fascism.
Oh, that's not where I thought you were going.
No. No, blowing stuff up will also come from Italy at some point. But the only other left unity group around at this point was the Italian Anti-Fascist Committee, which is basically people in Argentina who are either from Italy or specifically concerned with fighting fascism, which was at this point like kind of just in Italy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this group included liberals, socialists, anarchists, and communists. And at every meeting, they had speakers from all four tendencies. So it wasn't just like everyone can come. It's like, we know that there are four different groups here. All of them have a say because we are working together to stop fascism. And it's like one of those things that's like both really beautiful, but I can also see some of the anarchists were really upset about sharing the stage with the communists who had just massacred all these other groups. You know?
That's fair.
Yeah.
I'd be at least a little wary myself.
Yeah. And anti-fascism is the big thing in Argentinian radical politics at this point, right? I'm focusing, not yet, but I will be focusing more on the expropriators. But the anti-fascists and the trade unionists are doing all this incredibly important work. Probably more important work, frankly. But it's all tied together. They're not as distinct as people might want to make it. Not as distinct as La Protesta wants to claim. Because fascism is now picking up all across Europe. And a ton of Italian immigrants to Argentina are fleeing fascism. But it was also on the rise in Argentina.
Ruh-roh.
Yeah. Spoiler, 1930, the fascists will take control of Argentina and create a military dictatorship. So much of like 1920 to 1940 history can be understood as like all over the world. It was like, well, is it the anarchists, the communists, or the fascists who are going to successfully stage a revolution in this or that country against the like conservatives and the liberals?
Mm-hmm.
And the fascists are going to, the answer in Argentina is that the fascists are going to take control. So people who are fighting fascism are on to something, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. No, that's, yeah.
The way that fascism takes hold in general is through a combination of right-wing control of the state and right-wing paramilitary groups that operate like somewhat autonomously outside of it.
Good thing that stopped happening.
Yeah. It's totally a coincidence that you have the Patriotic League in Argentina and the Patriot Front in the United States now.
So uncreative.
I know. So the Patriotic League is this right-wing paramilitary organization. And in the rural areas, they have a sub-organization called the Organization for the Defense of Property. The best source I have on all of this is from a historian named Osvaldo Bayer. And he said, quote, "The landowners and their sons formed themselves into armed phalanxes and underwent military training so they would be prepared to defend themselves against the persistent agitation of the farm workers."
Those damn workers.
Yeah. On May 1st, 1921, there's huge May Day celebrations across the country because, of course, there were.
Yeah.
May 1st.
Yeah.
The Patriotic League counter-protested one of these demonstrations by throwing their own parade. A big patriotic display with representatives from all the Catholic schools. There's young girls scattering flowers in front of the parade. Lots of flags. All that shit.
That sounds whack as fuck.
It is. Then they went over to the anarchist labor rally. And when they saw the black and red flag, they got all mad and shit. And then they just massacred people.
Oh.
5 or 15 people were killed. The number of people wounded ranges from 33 to 5 times that. The right-wing press basically was like, well, 95% of the people at the anarchist rally were immigrants, so who cares?
Okay.
See how, you know, recently a judge, like, do you know more about this? How a judge recently said that undocumented people can have the right to bear arms in the United States, and then all the right-wingers are really upset about it, even though they supposedly like gun rights?
Yeah, I saw some of that on the gram.
Yeah.
On the gram.
That's, you know, they're like, people have a God-given right to bear arms. Not those
people.
But
not those people. Yeah, no.
Very
similar. Just the ones that are like me.
Yeah. The very next day, May 2nd, right-wing thugs killed 2 anarchist brothers in Buenos Aires.
For what?
I'm not sure. I think over a strike or something.
Oh.
So many fascist versus anti-fascist shootouts are about to happen that it becomes blurry.
Oh, okay.
Or rather, it gets skimmed over in the history that I've read about it. Soon enough, the anarchists are shooting back, right? They're like...
Hell yeah.
And they become an armed community.
Let's fucking go.
Pretty much as a result of the 1921 May Day thing, but I'm not 100% certain. So when fascists attacked striking dock workers, an anarchist and a Patriotic League guy both died in that particular attack. And so violence is in the air. Anarchists went armed, and they occasionally fought battles with cops as well as fascists. In the town of Jacinto Arruz, rising labor tensions caused cops to invite workers to come talk. Like, there's all these, like, rising tensions, right? And so the cops are like, oh, why don't all of you people who have problems with the labor stuff come on over down to the police station and we'll all talk it through. It's
for
totally
sure.
Not a trap. And so they go, and the workers who show up are disarmed and arrested. And the anarchists among the workers are like, nah, you can't do that. And so even though they are literally surrounded at gunpoint, they were like, fuck this, and they fought, and folks on both sides died.
Damn, did they win, or?
I mean, some of them probably
seems like
survived.
Bad odds. Yeah.
Yeah, it's often referred to as a massacre, but it's like, I think it is worth pointing out that it was a battle, and that the an armed group of people said, we are not going to let ourselves be arrested in this trap, you know?
Yeah, fair.
And what's funny is, so like, and this is a fairly like mainstream anarchist position, including like La Protesta and all these people who don't like the bandits. They're okay with self-defense and community defense, right? And so the anarchist papers have to start saying things like, hey folks, just as a heads up, for tomorrow's anarchist picnic, don't just like shoot guns into the woods. It scares the locals. It's a bad idea. Just you can bring your guns, but just don't shoot them randomly.
So you're telling me I just can't have any fun?
Pretty much, yeah. The anarchists hate fun.
I mean, I've heard that before.
Yeah. But it also means the anarchist movement was this huge thing. It was complete with family picnics and stuff like that, you know? And that's
that
like...
Both sides.
The stuff that I wish I knew more about with some of the cultural stuff. I love the, like, the defense stuff is defense of a beautiful cultural thing that they're building, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They also had a defense committee to help imprisoned comrades. And this raised money for defense, but it also planned escapes. It was called the Social Prisoners and Deportees Defense Committee.
Okay.
And they covered trial expenses. They took care of the families of imprisoned people. And they also had volunteers scouting out every prison and like just to like know all of the area around it, like know who lives near there, like what are the ways in, who works there, who can be bribed.
That is so fucking legit.
Yeah. They are bribing jailers to get stuff into prisons. They are renting getaway cars. They are occasionally bribing clerks into changing the sentences of prisoners.
I mean, you know, diversity of tactics.
Yeah. And the central figure of that group was Miguel Arcangel Rosinga, and he's a metal worker. I mentioned last time this other longstanding anarchist political prisoner, a guy named Simon Radowitzky, Simon who killed Ramon Falcon. He killed the cop responsible for firing into a crowd back in 1909. And the movement to spring him took 20 years and tried everything, including a lot of prison escape attempts. At one point, Miguel gets himself a job as a prison guard in Simon's prison. in order to break him out. But a competing union was like looking to discredit the anarchists. And they weren't even like trying to snitch him out as like, he's trying to plan an escape. I think they were just being like, yeah, well, the anarchists, one of them's a prison guard now. So like clearly.
Oh my God.
They're all a bunch of hypocrites, you know? So the jig was up and he was fired. But on his way out the door, and this is what everyone who quits jobs should do, especially if you're going to, this isn't an ad transition, but especially if you listen to that ad that's like, go become a jailer, this is what you should do. To quote, I mean, you shouldn't do this, it's not illegally, whatever. To quote Osvaldo Bayer, before he vanished, and lest all of his trouble have been for nothing, Rasinga torched the prison governor's home.
Fuck yeah, let's go.
Yeah. But the movement is splitting hard between the protestistas from La Protesta and the Antochistas from La Antorcha. And soon, the defense committee was split too. The protestistas would only support prisoners of conscience and not expropriators. Among the anarchist expropriators, there are three figures talked about the most, the sort of big men of history version of it, which is annoying, but I can't keep track of a million names and I don't want anyone else to have to, so I'm going to repeat some of it a little bit. They're each part of a different gang. One of them is our metal worker, Miguel Rasinga. Another is an Italian named Severino Di Giovanni. And he may or may not come back with his own episode someday. Kind of depends on how I'm feeling about him after I research him a little bit more. And there's more written about him in general. But there's one more figure that's important in all of this. Buenaventura Durruti, who we're going to talk about on Wednesday. This is only a cliffhanger if you know that he's a really important figure in the Spanish Civil War who like leads a massive army to try and defeat fascism. So here, that's context for you listeners about why that's such a cool cliffhanger. Now everyone knows that it was really cool.
Thank you for explaining that.
Yeah, no, it's well, literally my job. Yeah. But Snow, do you have anything you want to plug?
Yeah, some of you may remember me from Yellow Peril Tactical. We do firearms education, some political education, a lot of shit posts. But depending on when you listen to this, we're currently running a sticker fundraiser for Liberate Myanmar and Solidarity Collectives in Ukraine. So go check it out. Or you could just, you know, look at all our shit on Instagram, yellow_peril_tactical. Hell, and then yeah, our Twitter is YPTActual. So go check us out.
My favorite gun shit posters, just so people should know that.
Thank you.
I feel that way. If you want to know more about what I do, you can listen to my other podcast, Live Like the World is Dying, which comes out every Friday. And I'm the host every now and then because there's three hosts and it's about individual and community preparedness. And Sophie, what do you got to plug?
I want to plug a new show that's coming out in May, hosted by Jamie Loftus, that I'll be producing, called 16th Minute of Fame. The pause was for the parentheses. And it's a half-weekly, half-reported look into the internet's main characters that you may or may not have forgotten about. And I'm really excited about it. Jamie and I are working really, really hard on it. And the ideas Jamie has for the show are... You're going to love it. That's what I'll say, is Jamie's crushing it.
I'm pretty excited about having an ongoing Jamie Loftus podcast available.
Yeah. Oh, that's solid point. It's a weekly, baby.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So a weekly Loft.
Yeah.
Is that the hot dog person?
Yeah.
That is Miss Hot Dog herself, by the way. Buy her book, Raw Dog. Yeah. Oh, she'll be so happy that you referred to her that way, Snow.
Hot dog lady, you know, let's go.
Hot dog lady, my gal. But yeah, I'll look out for that one, and then at Cool Zone Media for the rest.
All right, see y'all on Wednesday.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, and Two Door Cinema Club.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.